Good afternoon, folks. Looking forward to a really great New Earth podcast today. Today we are going to be meeting Dr. Wayne Carmichael, algae expert, water quality expert, someone who knows a ton about Klamath Lake, and in particular, Phanizomenon flossaqua, the blue-green algae that we have so masterfully been collecting up in the Klamath Basin for quite some time now. So looking forward to a really fascinating science call today on the New Earth Podcast. Good afternoon, everybody, and really looking forward to this conversation with our guests. So once again, Wayne Carmichael. Wayne, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine, Kevin. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you for taking the time to be with us on the podcast today. I am very excited to talk to you and just get to know a little bit more about you and the benefit that you've been providing to our company, to New Earth, for quite some time now. So I guess my first question, where I wanted to start, was you have been involved in water quality and have known about blue-green algae and the Phanizomenon flossaqua for a really long time. You are probably one of the world's leading experts on this topic. How did you get from where you started your career into that niche?
Well, it would have to go back to when I was looking for a graduate program and got linked up with a well-known person in Canada who had studied artificial media for growing algae. And he was the very first one who worked out of Caltech right after the Second World War in developing artificial media for growing algae. Up until that time, there was no way of studying algae in the laboratory because we didn't know how to grow them. So, and this was especially with the blue-green algae as they were known then. Now we know them as cyanobacteria or blue-green bacteria. But so that really goes back that far. And I started with him in Canada at the University of Alberta in 1970 and spent the first few years learning how to culture and grow and study the cyanobacteria. And then got very interested in a peculiar aspect of them, and that is that there are a significant number of them that produce toxins that were responsible for animal poisonings, and went from there. So that's the short story. But I then spent my entire career, once I left Canada and moved back to the United States and Ohio, investigating these organisms, their toxins and water supplies, and why some lakes have them that are fairly clean lakes, and why some lakes who are naturally eutrophic and some that are eutrophic or nutrient rich from human activities. So that's how I came to learn about Klamath Lake around 1980, because Klamath Lake is unique in the sense that it is, and it was at that time, called a naturally eutrophic or naturally nutrient-rich lake, as opposed to ones that get, you know, agriculture or municipal runoff and are called culturally eutrophic lakes. And the population of a Phanizomenon on that lake, which had been there for quite some time, at least 50 to 60 years, recorded history, and went from there.
So
that was even before there was any harvesting of algae on the lake. So
that is fascinating. And as you mentioned, there's a lot of different kinds, and I don't want to dumb this down too much, but there's a lot of different kinds of cyanobacteria or blue-green algae, right?
Well, that's correct. There are roughly eight major groups or divisions or phyla, depending on how you look at it, of algae. Blue-green algae or cyanobacteria are really the smallest group in numbers of species. There's only a few thousand species as opposed to tens of thousands of species of the other divisions. But their unique position is that they were the, and are, the first photosynthetic organisms on Earth. So from the geologic record, we know that they've been around for probably roughly 3 billion years. And in fact, are responsible, largely responsible for the air that oxygen atmosphere that developed on Earth. So they've had a long time to fit into all the niches. So while they aren't necessarily dominant algae in many environments, they certainly are everywhere. You'll find them in Antarctica. You'll find them in the Arctic. You find them at very high altitudes on the sides of mountains. They are in hot springs in Yellowstone, growing at boiling temperatures. They can pretty much withstand any kind of environmental condition as long as they have light.
That is fascinating. So okay, blue-green algaes, we know that they have such a remarkable place in our history as a planet, right? But my other question is, how many of those, you said that they're a small number, there's only a few thousand, right? How many Correct. Of those are edible?
Well, technically speaking, they're all edible. Depends on your appetite, with the exception of those that produce poisons or toxins. And that's only a handful of those several thousand. The problem, for modern cultures is that our decreasing water qualities in many of our water supplies, surface water supplies, has set up conditions where those cyanobacteria or blue-green algae, they really like to grow, and they do very well. And so they outcompete other algae. And that's why we have the bad side of the cyanobacteria, blue-green algae question. But for the most part, they're perfectly good and edible, and many of them are. But we have, just like mushrooms, we like mushrooms, but there are a few that you don't want to eat. So it's the same with blue-green algae.
And we specifically, when it comes to the Upper Klamath Lake, we're talking about, of course, Phanizomenon. Now, I actually heard you say that differently. I want to make sure I say it exactly scientifically correct. How do you say it? A Phanizomenon flossaqua, is that correct?
Yes, right. Yes, I've heard it said different ways, but the Phanizomenon is probably the correct phonetic pronunciation.
So we have, in terms of edible microalgaes, right, we have a Phanizomenon, we have spirulina, that's also a blue-green algae. How does that differ from, say, like a chlorella?
Well, chlorella is a completely different division or phylum. So biochemically and otherwise, they are different. The unique thing about the blue-green algae is that being prokaryotic, in other words, more characteristic of bacteria, they don't have the hard cellulose wall that chlorella does. So chlorella is a true plant. It has all the characteristics of a plant in terms of its biochemistry, grasses and shrubs and things. So it has a cellulose cell wall. So that's the major difference. So that means that cyanobacteria, blue-green algae, are really, they have a cell wall that's more digestible. Therefore the nutrient contents of the cell are more available for ingestion and digestion. And so that's the main thing. There's good nutrient complement in chlorella and the other kinds of edible algae, because in terms of commercial algae, there are far more of those in those other divisions than there are in cyanobacteria, blue-green algae.
Interesting.
So it's true. But the main ones in the blue-greens are Phanizomenon and spirulina, which has been, its name has been changed. It's now technically Arthrospira, but commercially the word spirulina is still used when you purchase it. So those are the two groups, and they are separate genera, even though they're related in the same family. They are really the only blue green algae that are commercially worked with very much.
That is fascinating. So let's take this back to, you know, how it relates maybe to New Earth and what we're doing. How long historically have people, we often talk about ancient civilizations and that many of them used these kinds of microalgaes, culturally, it was part of their food source. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, the recorded, or at least the, you know, the anthropological use and understanding of algae as food goes back, oh, probably 5 or 6,000 years. The first recordings were in China, where you collected the algae literally off of a lake and consumed it. And in China, they used multiple ones. There's no suggestion there that it was a phanizomenon or even spirulina, but it was other blue-green were collected. In fact, some of the ones that they most used are found on Klamath Lake, too, but in fairly small amounts that, you know, wouldn't make a commercial effort. But those are in a group called Nostoc, and there is a Nostoc species on Klamath Lake. You know it as mare's egg, which would be part of that ancient food from thousands of years ago. So the use of the next one that would have been used from the blue-green algae would be spirulina. And the evidence for spirulina also goes back at least hundreds, probably close to 1,000 years, because it was consumed a lot in Mexico and Central South America, again, scooped off the surface of lakes and dried and actually carried as a high-nutrient trail food for the Native Americans in Central and South America and Mexico.
And these, I guess
sorry,
it's...
One other thing, spirulina also has an ancient history in Africa for the same reason, especially in areas like Ethiopia, where it actually has a historical name called Dihi, D-I-H-I, and it, in those situations, was scooped off the surface of shallow lakes and dried into cakes and was used in soups and sauces as a protein supplement. In fact, at certain times in the year when other protein sources weren't available, it became the primary protein source for those native peoples in Africa. So that's, again, been used for hundreds, if not thousands of years.
Yeah, yeah. And we always tend to talk a little bit about the nutrient density, particularly of the phanizomenon floss aqua. Tell us a little bit about the nutrient density of that, and why is it such a good food to be adding to your diet?
Well, again, I think it comes back to the other algae like chlorella having much of its density or mass is what I would refer to it as, is largely a cellulose material. So that means not having that in the blue-green algae, there's more available protein per gram or per pound, however you want to think of it, in the blue-green algae than there is in this other algae. So that's why I think what you're referring to is as nutrient density, but it's really the the biomass of the cell. If you take out all the water, what percentage of that is good nutrients, like protein, of course. And there are other, most all of the cyanobacteria, blue-green algae, approach the nutrient density of a phanizomenon. But a phanizomenon, of course, because of its ability to grow continuously year after year after year on Klamath Lake, allows you to make a commercial harvest of it. You won't find any other lake in the United States that has a consistent production of a phanizomenon than Klamath Lake. In fact, if you, in terms of anywhere in the world, you'd have to go to some of the Rift Valley lakes in Africa to find lakes that might produce a phanizomenon fairly consistently there, it would actually be more spirulina or Arthrospira than a phanazonon. So that makes Klamath Lake very unique. And of course, that's what's attracted me since those early days too, to the lake.
Fascinating. Now, you mentioned something called mare's eggs. And we will be having an event in July, which I'm really excited that you're going to be speaking at. And we do an eco tour. We take people around and show them the environment where we collect this algae. And mare's eggs has always been, you know, kind of talked about in a really kind of hushed tones, like how precious and special these things are. Tell us a little bit more about what that is.
Well, I totally agree. They are precious, although I probably wouldn't use that term. I'd use something that's a little more familiar to me. You know, like it is a rare species and a rare ecology that supports the mare's egg. You have to have very cold water, and it has to be fairly, very clean water. And that's why you don't find mare's eggs growing in the open lake on Klamath Lake. You have to go up to the areas where those underground springs are coming out of Pelican Butte and Crater Lake to get that really underground, cold, clean, clear water. And that's what they prefer. So there are only a fairly few places. And it's not just Klamath Lake. There's also one of the springs, Spring Creek, I think, is
right
further. That one harbors a lot of mare's eggs at its source, too. But the ones on Klamath Lake, historically, it was actually a natural area designated by the Forest Service because it's over on Forest Service land on the far west, northwest side of the lake. And it's called Mare's Egg Springs. And it used to be well signed and marked, but people didn't treat it very nicely. And also some of the farming practices that abutted that area of the springs, there was some development which was threatening to alter the water flow there. So they largely addressed that, the Forest Service has. But as a consequence, I think you'd have to say that the mare's eggs were endangered and still are to a certain extent, and that's kind of what makes them precious, I guess. Plus the fact that where they grow is so unique,
and, right?
It wouldn't take much to disturb the ecology of where they grow, such that they wouldn't grow.
Right.
In fact, one of the areas that they were found and still are found is Harriman Springs, and you now have that new resort complex there, which the last time I was looking is definitely compromising the nostoc or the mare's eggs in that area. So the best place to find them is still Mare's Egg Springs, which is a few miles up, you know, the road on the west side. And it's not marked, and it's a very small parking area. There's no trail down to the springs anymore. I have mixed feelings about taking a large group to a place like that. I think that you need to be careful because there are still, a lot of people who would like to collect and eat the mare's eggs because, again, historically in Asia, they are a delicacy. And they are in South America, too. In fact, the increase in sort of indigenous new foods, you'll find high-end restaurants in Peru and now translating that to even New York, will have specialty servings of mare's eggs. And those, as far as I know, are not able to be grown or collected in great numbers. So it's still a kind of a specialty food item. So I have certain hesitations personally about making the whereabouts of Klamath Lake mare's eggs known to a lot of people. I guess that's my feeling.
You know what? You may have just gotten those removed from the eco tour, and that would be okay with us because the company.
I can certainly put some lovely photographs into my talk. And hopefully that might satisfy.
Let's do that. Yeah, let's do that. That's a fair point. And I think a really interesting one, because you're right. It is a special ecosystem. It's a very unique ecosystem up there, and it needs to be protected and taken care of. One of the things that I wanted to go out on an edge a little bit and ask you about, talk to you about. Some people have claimed that the only reason a Phanazomenon grows there in the Upper Klamath Lake is because the lake is a because the lake is unhealthy, or because of a lot of the, you know, toxins and poisons or whatever that farmers have dumped into that lake. And without that, it wouldn't grow. Tell us a little bit about what you know about the environment, and if that's an accurate assessment, that if farmers stopped poisoning the lake, that the algae would stop growing. Is that true?
Well, I would take almost the opposite. I think it's because the lake is uniquely, its unique ecology and environment allows it to grow. And it doesn't mean that human activity hasn't impacted it to a certain extent. But I don't think it's impacted it to a detrimental extent. And let me try and explain that. The Phanazomenon has been growing in that lake since at least the first settlements. At least as near as I can tell from the historical record. I took a class in phycology or algology at Oregon State back in the 60s from a fellow named Dr. Harry Finney, who did some of the earliest studies on the lake, published a paper in 1964 and used the term naturally eutrophic and provided a bit of history. I then went back and looked at the history of those as well. And when people's, you know, when white settlers, Western settlers, went into the lake, they collected ice from the lake because they didn't have refrigeration. And they were actually green ice being recorded at that time. And, of course, this was back in the turn of the century. So I think that the Phanazomenon has certainly been there since about the 30s or the 40s. It has increased in abundance, and I think that can be attributed at least in part to the creation of the canal system and the damming of the, you know, the south end of the lake, so that the water levels were being maintained more in a stable fashion so that you could have, you know, adequate water for irrigation. I think those conditions have helped to increase and stabilize the biomass of Phanazomenon on the lake. But that's not necessarily a negative. Certainly the agriculture activities of having thousands of animals pasture at the north end of the lake during the summertime contributes to the nutrient input. But the natural sources of nutrients, especially phosphorus, coming out of that, you know, sort of snow-fed underground waters in volcanic soils contributes more of the phosphorus than any animal activity. So I would argue that, no, it is not human pollution that is largely responsible for the Phanazomenon, but it has helped to maintain it and perhaps, you know, allow it to have those high biomasses that you see during the summer. My concern, and that would be continued nutrient enrichment from human and animal activities primarily, will cause the biomass of that lake to go from a Phanazomenon to a type of blue-green algae that needs nitrogen. You recognize that Phanazomenon is a nitrogen fixer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So nitrogen is not overabundant in the lake. Otherwise, you wouldn't have a nitrogen-fixing organism. But if too much nitrogen gets into the lake from agriculture and human activities, then you'll start to switch to an undesirable blue-green algae that likes having preformed nitrogen, and that organism is Microcystis, and that has been the tip of the iceberg of what I consider to be the situation that you want to avoid in Klamath Lake.
Right. And there are folks that know that seek to take care of that lake, right?
Oh yeah, there are wonderful activities that are taking place. The USGS and their monitoring programs, and the Nature Conservancy that's helped to secure some of those farmlands at the upper part of the lake and help reconvert them. But I don't see again that Phanizomaron's presence is a direct consequence of human activity. So I think that's my argument. I stick with it. And I think that most of the people that have worked long-term on the lake, like Dr. Jake Kahn, who did his PhD thesis on the lake, and the USGS people as well, would agree with that. But walking the line between maintaining that lake for agricultural water source and reducing the nutrient inputs, like any lake, is always a difficult situation. Plus, you have so many entities that have a direct interest in the lake. You have the tribes, you have the USGS, you have the Forest Service, you have the agriculture people.
There's a lot of people on top of it.
Then there's you, who likes harvesting the algae, and of course your competitors on the lake as well. So there's no question that Klamath Lake is, a good example of all of the many issues that we have with regards to maintaining water quality in the 21st century. that certainly needs careful watching. I think the nice thing is, the great thing is that, that you recognize that need. And at least I think what's happened in the 30, 35 years or so that you've been harvesting on the lake is that there have been quite a number of other agencies that have taken up the cause, and it doesn't fall to New Earth so much as it used to maintain the lake. But there are certainly challenges, and they're going to be there forever. So we just have to work with it from now on.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit, if we could, about the nutritional value, which is something we talk about frequently, the nutritional value of this organism. And that is, it's loaded with things that you don't typically expect in a plant, right? Well, I'm being that it's not necessarily, a plant as you commonly view it, like the vitamins, minerals, fatty acids, chlorophyll, phycocyan, and all of the rest. And particularly the amino acids. What can you tell us about the components, the bioactive components that are in that organism?
Well, being an organism that photosynthesizes and a living cell in itself, it's going to have a whole range of those compounds. The amino acid composition, I've looked at, I haven't actually done composition, nutrient composition. Your company has had that done, plus others. So you're more familiar with exactly what those are. I do know that the nutrient complement, whether you're considering amino acids or you're considering full proteins or whether you're considering, organic acids and vitamins and fatty acids and lipids and the whole range of things, it is a good source. But the cyanobacteria, blue-green algae in general, are all that way. But the Phanizomaron, I don't think, is unique in terms of the blue-green algae, but it certainly is unique relative to a nutrient-rich food. So I have no problem saying that. What I have less of an understanding and appreciation of would be some of those specialty compounds that might be people attribute to the special effects, the feel-good effects, or the the more healthy things that you get from them, other than it being a good nutrient source. It is a good complement of nutrients. There's no question about that.
Yeah. Well, and it also tends to pick up a lot of minerals, trace minerals, because of the environment, I suppose, that it's in, right?
Right. I'm not so much familiar with those either, but, you know, if you're speaking of, you know, manganese and cobalt and some of those other trace metals, I do think that they're certainly present.
Excellent. So tell us a little bit about, some of the research that you've been up and visited Klamath Lake with us quite a few times. Tell us a little bit about, you know, some of your past experiences with that and maybe some of the work that you've done, the studies that you personally have done on the lake with the algae.
Well, my studies have been in more with blue-green algae that are a problem, blue-green algae, ones that really produce the toxins. I have studied the Phanizomonon and Phanizomonon from Klamath Lake. I have brought it into my lab and cultured it, but it was more to prove that there was no detrimental effect from the algae than other things. And I am very comfortable in saying that the Phanizomonon flows off from Klamath Lake is a perfectly safe alga relative to the other blue-green algae that might be a problem. And my work on the lake has largely been to help the industry, the harvester industry, recognize when there's a problem and when there's a developing problem and when best to harvest and how to harvest and how to clean up the product and how to test for the product. And so that's where I've done most of my work. And that's largely been for the industry. In terms of basic research that I've done from a Phanizomonon, it would be how to grow it in the lab and study it and test it for its detrimental effects and some of those things. And then studying some of the other algae, because of course, while Phanizomonon does dominate the lake at times, almost 100%, in the spring, you're going to have other blue-green algae like Anabaenas and Gliotrichia and diatoms, and later in the summer, you start to get the contaminant Microcystis, and that's the one you want to avoid. And of course, you know, what are the swings in production on the lake? You know, because the algae biomass goes up, and then it goes down, and then it comes back up, and when is it best to harvest? Those are the things that I paid more attention to. From the point of view of Phanizomonon. And that's one of the fascinating things about the lake. And then, of course, being able to travel the full length of the lake and get up to the upper part of the lake, the Klamath Marsh areas, and, of course, things like the Nostoc mare's eggs, which are highly unique because you'll have a high biomass out on the lake where you're harvesting. And if you go up to Rocky Point and up into there, the water's clear and clean because it's they're being influenced much more there by the underground cold spring water.
Very good. Very good. So for those that are listening to the podcast today, tell us a little bit, if they wanted to know more and be able to do a little more research, where would they look? Where would you recommend they go?
Well, there are publications on the nutrient the nutrient components of the Phanizomonon. There are also studies in the literature with spirulina and a Phanizomonon on some of the more, direct medical type beneficial effects of the algae. If someone wanted to just study the general biology or the natural history, there aren't specific books on it. I've always thought there really isn't much. There would be a place in the literature for a nice little manual talking about the natural history and the ecology and biology of a Phanizomonon, but there doesn't really exist one.
I know of an audience that would buy that book if you wrote it. I am aware of an audience that would buy it immediately. Well,
it would be welcome. It would be fun to do, and it's a challenge. But yeah, someday you should do that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I just wanted to say thank you so much for the conversation today. I know that all of us are really looking forward to you coming to speak with the group at New Earth University in July. So I'd recommend everybody that's interested, please get registered, stop on by, and you're going to hear from Dr. Wayne Carmichael. Absolutely a phenomenal and intriguing body of research, and a great verification that the quality of what we do is heading in the right direction. And thank you to you for putting us on that right track so that we know that what we're doing is healthy and safe and good for folks.
Well, absolutely, Kevin. Look forward to seeing you in July.
Excellent. Thanks a lot. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye now.